So we're going to do some concentration practice, which is the breath counting, and then some insight practice. The first thing to do is check the posture. So if you're sitting in a chair, plant your feet so you have a good solid base. If you're sitting on a cushion, arrange the legs so they'll be comfortable for the period of sitting. If you have a good back, maybe sit away from the back of the chair. But if you notice that you have back pain when you're sitting, it's okay to lean against the chair. What we're hoping to do with the posture is have a bright mind. And leaning or slouching tends to indicate to the mind that it's okay to go to sleep. And so we want to defeat that mechanism. Hold your hands in a mudra. I would recommend that you place your right hand on top of your left with your thumbs touching. When you tend to start spacing out, what you'll notice is that you drop the thumbs, and so it's like a canary in the coal mine, letting you know that you're getting caught up in thinking. You can leave the hands in the lap, but if you notice the mind is sleepy, if you just lift the hands up a couple of inches, it creates a tension in the torso, which tends to brighten the mind. Straighten the spine. So you want to have a straight spine, one vertebrae stacked up on top of another. Intentionally relaxing the shoulders, tucking in the chin, placing the tongue on the roof of the mouth, and closing the eyes. We'll do a breath counting strategy, counting from 1 to 5 on both the out-breath and the in-breath. So breathing out, count 1. Breathing in, count 1. Breathing out, count 2. Breathing in, count 2. Breathing out, count 3. Breathing in, count 3. Breathing out, count 4. Breathing in, count 4. Breathing out, count 5. Breathing in, count 5. And then begin the process again at 1. If you lose the count, as soon as you're aware of it, just bring your attention back to the sensations of the breath and begin the count again at 1. No big deal, even if you have to do it over and over. So let go of the breath counting or concentration practice and begin doing the see, hear, feel technique. I'll give the instructions again. If your attention is drawn to an aspect of visual experience, note that. That is to say, know that your attention is in visual experience. Soak into the sensing experience and then generate the auditory label see. If your attention is drawn to auditory experience, know that, so either external sound or internal auditory thinking. Know that that's where it is, soak into the sensing experience, and then generate the label here. No need to label the label. And then if your attention is drawn to a felt sense in the body, know that that's where your attention is. Soak into the sensing experience, then generate the label, feel. I'll do a little out loud. Feel. Feel. Hear. 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 Hear, feel, you get the idea. So don't fret too much about this. You can be late. You can miss it altogether. You can be wrong. If you're not sure what the sensation is, you can guess. Easy peasy. if you find that you get pulled away into thinking quite a bit, you may want to increase the frequency of the noting, even if that means that you're just continuously noting, leaving no gaps for the mind to hijack you into thinking. So, any comments or questions on what we just did? What was? Yeah. Yeah. Is that a good thing? Okay, awesome. She said that she found that the internal experience, I guess, was very active, and so that there was a lot to do, a lot to note. Uh-huh.
Hello.
Okay.
Hi.
Thank you.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Just to make sure that I understood correctly. Are we supposed to come back to the breath or no?
There's no anchor for the breath.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
And what is the meditation called again?
See, hear, feel.
Right. Thank you so much.
That was the experience. I was struggling with.
1 sec. He's got the mic and then he'll give it to you.
Hi. Yeah, I didn't like it.
Before you go on, can I ask you one thing? Is there anything you do like?
Well, it's silent meditation. And what I found was that I was almost searching for thoughts to label.
Uh-huh.
Instead of they're coming automatically. And I found that I was feeling more in my body than anything else.
Okay, good.
As a tool, I don't know how it will help me.
Okay.
That's all.
All right. What it can do is or give you an insight which you had, which was that there was a lot of feeling in the body, and then it can begin to connect this thought has this feeling to it. Then it can connect that this is the reaction to the present moment, and then all of a sudden I'm thinking, and that thought generates a feeling, it masks the, or takes me out of the present moment. All of those different processes that the body-mind engages in as a way of being in the world becomes apparent by tracking the processes that they manifest in. That's what's useful about it.
Just to echo what he said, I felt very sort of lost, unanchored, that there was a lot of feelings coming on at once, sometimes simultaneously. The feeling of being pushed from one thought to the other,
right,
without pause, sometimes using my old techniques of trying to bring it back in breath, feeling like I wasn't getting distance from the feelings. Other than the words, the word labels were very auditory for me. One thing I did find very useful was seeing which of the three categories predominated throughout it.
Right.
Which for me was feeling, and what information I can take from that. Do you have any remarks about how to use that information?
Well, in feeling, but it also sounds like the feeling state that you were in was lacking equanimity. So that one of the things about doing this technique is that you can come into more and more equanimity with just whatever is happening at the moment, which also can be useful. A lot of times when we bring our attention to something for the first time, it's alarming to us because we haven't really had awareness of it before. But then you get used to these patterns of the flow of experience. What you'll begin to track, I think, is also that the feeling states arise and pass, that they're not permanent, that they don't last forever. And that also helps it helps you find equanimity with the experience of them. And in some sense, what you really get to know intimately is yourself and your own processes, which is also useful. Most of the time, these things have been going on inside of us for so long that we don't really have even an awareness that they're happening in the moment that they're happening. Then this really turns a light on that so that we can see what's happening. Was the emotion the response to the conditions of the present moment, or was the emotion driven by the thinking process? And then if you notice that the thinking process is driving the afflictive emotional states, and then you notice that most of the time you're walking around in afflictive emotional states that are driven by thinking, that you can stop those thoughts and relieve yourself of the afflictive emotional experience, that can be very useful. That's making sense. Good. I used to say in early sobriety, why am I trying to save this person I hardly know and probably won't like?
My experience was rather surprising. I think I liked it. I found myself noting almost constantly, and I think it was a kind of alert state. I was alert to see what would be coming in, hearing, seeing, feeling.
Good.
And as I got into it, oddly enough, in one respect, my mind was active in the sense of being alert. But in another way, it stopped the internal generation of thoughts, and I actually became very relaxed.
Oh, good, yeah.
So it felt very peaceful, even though I was alert. And for experiences, I felt very peaceful and relaxed.
Wonderful. Good.
Thank you for the technique.
Yeah. There's one over there.
Parsing of the thought process, the thoughts that were kind of interrupting, actually started kind of becoming more clear as either an auditory, an internal auditory or internal visual. So that was actually kind of a new refinement.
Wonderful.
In terms of being able to identify thoughts and then let them pass.
Great. I think that you'll find that there's an auditory, which is usually back, a visual, which is usually slightly in front, and also a felt sense in the body, and that's the complete experience of a thought, that each thought has its emotional component to it. Some people are predominantly auditory, and there's more of you than people who are predominantly visual in their thinking process. So, awesome.
All right. Basically, I've been doing two major practices, counting the breath, and also the Vipassana or Vipassana, focusing on the body. And this was interesting. And I was also doing the practice of also including the smell and taste.
Right.
So I had five senses. But I was focusing on mostly the seeing, the hearing, and the feeling. But I wouldn't allow for it to pop up like which it is. I would imagine beforehand, oh, now I'm going to visualize something.
Uh-huh.
Now I'm going to focus on what a sensation. Now I'm going to focus on what I'm hearing.
Right. So a lot of control issues.
No, what I'm saying is I'm going to say, okay, now I'm going to feel, now I'm going to hear, now I'm going to see.
Right.
Before I go to here.
Right.
And I was bouncing around, and it was interesting, because I was occupying my mind without thinking.
Right, totally.
No story, no self. And it was a good practice. I think I might continue using it.
Yeah, wonderful.
And also the hand. mudra. I have been practicing the left and the right.
Oh.
I said, well, let me try it this way. You know, and it's like weird. It's like, wow, you know.
I don't know the reason for it. I just know that that's the instruction.
Right.
So that's
right.
What I give.
So, yeah, I was hoping to try you know, different, something new. So,
good. Mm-hmm. There's one. Oh.
Hello. I thought it was very useful because I'm accustomed to focusing on a mantra. So for me, it was very liberating to acknowledge the feelings finally, as opposed to just trying to let them pass. Because I sometimes have heart palpitations in the beginning of meditation, so it's feel.
Right.
Feel. So it was kind of liberating in a way to finally acknowledge those feelings. As opposed to trying to sort of mask them. So it was interesting.
Wonderful. There's one here, I think.
I have to say that I was afraid to even close my eyes. I thought if I close my eyes, I'll die. So I was terrified. And I just had to kind of move my way through it.
So did you leave your eyes open?
I did. Yeah,
good.
Because I thought I would die if I closed that. And like you just said, what did you just say about wonder why I'm trying to save the person that I probably like anyway?
Yeah, this is one of my first great statements to my sponsor.
Yeah, well, you know, so I sort of wonder now, who is this I that I won't like? Who is it?
Right.
I want to say, who is who?
It's just really an activity, so.
Well, what does that mean?
I know it's one of those bummer Buddhist answers.
Well, yeah. If I'm not Buddhist, I know, like, the answers are nothing that makes sense. So is the answer just, like, just don't make sense?
I think the Buddha said you could meet everybody in the world and that you would find no one more deserving of your love and care than yourself. We often grow up in family systems where we're not cherished, not delighted in, and so we don't develop that skill of delight for ourselves. But as it turns out, it's learnable. You can learn it. You can learn to delight in yourself. You can learn in the exploration of yourself to cherish yourself. You can learn good care for yourself. And then as you begin to do those things, the choices that you make in the world are different. And so I like to talk about karma as the choices that you have after you've taken an action. If you take a skillful action, then you have some choices that come back. And if you take an unskillful action, then you have some choices that come back. They're often different choices.
So is this particular form of meditation a way to, you know, sort these things out?
It is.
I mean, where is the connection? I'm going to pull this back on you. But to cherish oneself, that could take forever. You know what I mean? If you start out like zero, you know, like, where is this connection here between cherishing oneself?
It doesn't have to take forever. Shinzen answers in all questions of time 5 years. And then he says, what else are you going to do? Suffer?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what I've done so far.
Right.
So,
right.
Another 5 years.
When I stopped drinking, I had been trying to stop drinking for a long time. Well, I say drinking, but drinking is a metaphor for the cocktail of chemicals that I would imbibe, right? It's an euphemism for that. It's essentially at the end of my using, it was a euphemism for whatever you had that I could take, but that's another story. I felt immediate relief because I wasn't so sick all the time from using, and that persisted for a while. But then I kept doing the same things I always did that caused my life to be in a state of constant havoc. And so then I began to address the havoc of my life, and as I sorted through it, there was less havoc. One of the things that's useful to pay attention to is what has meaning, what has real meaning to you. And how much of your time do you spend engaged in activities that actually have meaning for you? This is an important question. We often organize our lives in such a way that we spend almost no time doing things that are actually meaningful to us. And then we're in a state of despair, and we find that life is meaningless because we spend so little time engaged in the activity, in activities that have meaning. And so this would be supposing that you had the early conditioning that allowed you to discover what was meaningful. If you don't know what was meaningful, if you don't know what is meaningful to you, then you can't organize your life around being engaged in activities that are meaningful to you. So you need to begin to explore the process of finding meaning. What is it that does so? My first sponsor said to me, so for instance, George, what's your favorite apple? And I said, I don't like apples. They're green and sour and hard to chew. And he said, well, that sounds like a Granny Smith apples. There are other kinds of apples. Have you tried them? And I said, no, I always just get the Granny Smith apples. So he said, go to the Korean deli, buy two apples, eat them both. The next day, go and buy the one that you liked better and one that you haven't tried yet. And at the end of it, you'll know which apples you like the best. And at the end of it, I like Gala apples the best. And I like Pink Ladies the second best. And I don't like Granny Smith apples, and I don't know why I ate them for so long. What was important is not so much about the apples, but the process of learning to explore the things that you could be engaged in doing and then finding meaning in them. How do you find meaning in your life so that the activity that you spend the majority of your time, can you organize your life in such a way that the majority of your time is spent in activities that have real meaning to you? And if you do that, you really begin to value your life. Anybody want to argue that being strung out is painful? Let's call it this level of pain. If you live your life so that you're in this much pain, this looks like relief. Right? And you're totally willing to trade this little bit of relief for the consequences of using. You don't even think twice about it. I'm in so much pain, I can get a little bit of relief. It'll cause total havoc. But who cares? In the moment, I just need the relief. If you live your life where the pain of living is down here and this is the pain of using, it never looks good. You never really want to go back to it. There's always an option other than this, which will completely tank, I don't know about you, but at the end of my life, my drinking, the episodes were completely unpredictable. I'd have a drink and come to 4 days later after a train of wreckage, or I could drink and drink and drink and not feel enough of an effect to be relieved anyway. Is that making sense? I want to talk a little bit about the process of of relapse prevention, because I think that's important. Once you stop using, you have the same chance to say, stay in remission that everybody else has. And then depending on how you respond to different experiences, may put you in the direction of lapsing. If you lapse enough, you tend to relapse. So if we could say relapse is where you're using at the same level as when you were using before the last time you tried to stop. The lapse might be a single episode. One of the things about the 12-step world is we're very absolute about relapsing. You have to start your day count over. That can have an effect of causing people to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Well, I have to start my day count over. Anyway, I might as well really make it worthwhile. We are biochemical beings, and we also have emotional responses. If you look at what an emotion is, it's a response to the conditions of the present moment. In some sense, what the body-mind is doing is preparing to take an action in response to the perception of what's happening. And we feel those physiological changes in the body, and we call those emotions. When you were a child, your caregiver would have explained this to you. They would have been holding you, and you would have been fussing, and they would be going, oh, are you sad? Are you angry? Are you frustrated? What is it you are? And then they would land on something. And then they would tell you that that's what you were feeling. And you would identify that sensation with what they told you you were feeling based on their empathetic experience of it. So there aren't universal emotions. There's emotions within family systems. And depending on how robust your emotional education was or how limited, you'll have a good understanding of your emotional life, or you won't have much understanding. Some people have almost no instruction. They really couldn't identify an emotional feeling from a physical feeling because of that. Dan Siegel says that there's a window of tolerance of emotional intensity that you can just manage. So if something happens in the present moment and there's an emotional response to it and it falls within that window of tolerance, you can just deal with it. It just rolls off you. But if the emotional response is more intense than your window of tolerance, and some people will have a big range of emotional intensity and some people will have a narrow range. This is, again, based on the conditioning of your early family life. If an emotional event exceeds your window of tolerance, you'll have an emotional event which needs to be regulated. And if the way that you're currently set up in your body-mind to regulate it is by using, the thought of using will enter the mind. It's called craving. The first conduit to relapse is called craving and urging. Something happens and you think of using out of the blue. So if you've had long-term sobriety, maybe that doesn't happen very often because you created alternatives to using to regulate yourself. But if you're new, maybe that happens quite a bit, you think of using. What the body-mind is telling you is that you're in an emotional event that needs to be regulated, and this is how you should regulate it. So what we need to do if we want to stay abstinent is train ourselves to use an alternative strategy to regulate. But what can often happen is that the mind can start thinking about using. This is a self-generated emotional response to the need to regulate. And thinking about using tends to generate a feeling state in the body, which is self-soothing of the distress of the present moment. You following me on this so far? One of the things that the research that I'm describing was done by Alan Marlatt at the University of Washington, that if you allow yourself to think or fantasize or remember how great using was, you're more likely to relapse than if you don't allow that. The thought of using creates a pleasant feeling in the body, which tends to regulate the emotional situation that you're in. But you don't tend to address the underlying cause of the emotional distress because you're in thought, fantasizing. And if the stress level continues to rise, what do you notice about stress and the ability to think clearly? They're sort of inversely proportioned, right? The more stress, the less clear you think. You'll get to a certain point where you won't be able to tell that the self-soothing fantasy of using is not an actual plan of action, and you'll end up lapsing. The lapsing will bring down the stress level. Your cognitive mind will turn back on and you go, oh my God, I've lapsed, which then creates another emotional situation that needs to be regulated. You'll think of using if that's how you regulate that. And you'll be in a cycle that leads into relapse. Does that make sense? So one of the things to unwind that process is to pay attention to whether you allow yourself to fantasize or fondly remember using and prevent yourself from doing it. What I would recommend you do is some kind of meditation technique to replace the thought of using as a way of emotionally regulating. So you could use do you know loving kindness practice or metta practice as a way of doing that? Or you could use even the see, hear, feel technique that I taught you tonight. So the first module of this program is paying attention to craving and urge. Craving takes a long time to condition the mind out of because you have to completely replace all of the regulation strategies with using. If you've used for a long time, you use using to regulate pretty much everything. We used to say, it's a 2-beer job or it's a 5-beer job. I mean, it was really down to that, right? Everything was regulated by some kind of using. Is that making sense? The second main conduit to relapse is called stress, anger, and depression. Did anybody notice in their using history that you were sometimes depressed? I know. That's kind of rhetorical in a way, the question. People who have addiction have what's called, or very commonly have what's called atypical depression, which is a kind of, cycling depression. And this is related to thinking. So again, we're talking about the emotional regulation system. You think a thought that generates an emotion which is masking of the present moment or regulating of the present moment. It isn't that this is a bad thing to do. We all do it. Some of the strategies we'll have learned will be good strategies, and some of the strategies we'll have learned will be unskillful. And so we have to pay attention to them. The reason it's called anger is that anger is one of the most common ways that people with addictive patterns tend to regulate their emotion. They self-generate anger. Have you ever noticed that you might think thoughts that end you up in a state of anger? But not everybody uses anger, but it's one of the most common. All your life, you've been using thoughts that generate anger as a way of regulating the emotion of the emotional response of the present moment. And most of us have done it so well that 3 or 4 words into the narrative that we tell ourselves, we begin to become enraged by the narrative. I had a wonderful loft on 11th and Broadway, which I dearly loved, which I was evicted from in 1983. We were all living there illegally, and they got a conscience and threw us out. But I could be living in Los Angeles in the mid-2000s and think of that, being kicked out of there and be instantly enraged by that, right? What does it have to do with anything that's current in my life? Nothing. But what it does do is generate rage, which regulates the experience of the present moment. So one way to tell whether you're actually engaged in the experience of the present moment or you're not is, are you thinking about something in the past, or are you projecting about something in the future. And if you're doing that, it's very likely that what you're attempting to do is regulate the experience of the moment by taking yourself out into something that causes intense emotion. Is that making sense? The body-mind is biochemical, so in order to have an intense emotional experience, the body has to dump a ton of chemicals into the soup in order for you to feel that intensely. And the saturation of those chemicals can get so rich that you're actually in danger of physically damaging the receptors in the brain. The flow of those chemicals is regulated by the limbic system, you know, the brain. So you have a brain stem, which is the base of the limbic system, or the mammalian brain. It's in the center of the brain. And it kind of radiates outward to the rest of the brain, the frontal cortexes and so on, the emotional content. When the limbic system is shut down, the body-mind does it so that it can protect the other parts of the brain and the receptors in there. But it's also what we know as depression. We don't feel anything. So that if you don't pay attention to the thought processes you use to regulate your emotions, you can easily think yourself into depression. And so those of us who grew up in family systems where addiction is a common way of being in the world, it's also ordinary for us to have grown up with caregivers who taught us to use afflictive emotion as a way of regulating. Anger being the most popular, sadness is a close second. Some people regulate with fear. So you're generating, if you notice that the mind is catastrophizing, then what you're doing is regulating your experience of the present moment by generating fear. If you notice that you're constantly in a state of melancholy, it may be that you're generating sadness as a way of regulating. Again, thank you for your tolerance for the cold. What we need to do is begin to pay attention to the thought processes and change them so that we stop using afflictive strategies. Thank you. What you'll notice is when you pay attention to this, that you'll have a handful of stories that generate anger, a handful of stories that generate sadness, a handful that generate fear. If you use shame, you'll have a handful that generate shame. Maybe stories isn't a good word, or themes. You'll have themes. I like to give them pithy names. So I have Superman. This is the fantasy of me swooping in and saving the day. I have a lot of revenge scenarios that I play. Righteous anger. Does anything feel better than righteous anger? I have one called the Ranter, which is like a homeless person walking down the street screaming at everybody. Kind of like that one. But you'll notice that you have these patterns. And the reason that they tend to lead to relapse is because they lead to depression. And the depression is the thing that becomes unbearable. In order to turn back on, you turn toward substances that will be enlivening or make you feel better, make you feel anything, really, if the cycling depression goes too long. It takes about 2 hours or so for the liver to filter out all of those chemicals, and then the limbic system will switch back on. But if the experience of the depression has been debilitating and you haven't addressed the conditions of your life, you're often facing worse and worse conditions when the depression ends, which puts you into the emotional distress, which causes the cycle to repeat. So as it moves on, you can spend more and more time in depression. So is that making sense?
Uh-huh.
sure you said this, I don't catch it. Fear and sadness, and how those are kind of regulatory functions?
Sure. It doesn't... It may be counterintuitive. Something happens in the present moment which frightens you. And then the mind turns on a story that's intensely sad, and you're overwhelmed by a wave of sadness which completely blankets or suppresses the awareness of the fear. So you're not in the experience of fear, you're in the experience of sadness. And then when the everything's impermanent, when the fear ends, the mind turns off the story that was generating the sadness and you come back into balance. That's how it works. Something happens, it makes you angry. And in your family system, anger was regulated by fear. The mind thinks of a story that makes you intensely frightened. You're no longer angry, you're frightened. And then when the arising and passing of the experience of the present moment changes, the mind turns off the fear-generating story and you come back into balance. Is that making sense? What I suggest you do is you begin to track this to see how you respond. Are you in the experience of the present moment, or are you in the process of thinking? When you get back home at the end of the day and somebody says to you, "What did you do today, honey?" And you think back and you can't remember a single thing that happened all day long, it's because all day long you've been in thought and not in the experience of the present moment, so that this process has been happening to you all day long. What happens when you use strong emotion to regulate the experience of the present moment, you can often drive the mind into an intensity of emotion that it can't hold. And so it then suppresses that and stores it in the body as somatic emotional experience. Are you familiar with the term somaticized emotion? In childhood in particular, if you grow up in family systems where people don't take care of you and aren't sensitive to your mind states and don't help you regulate your emotional experiences, you're constantly in a state of overwhelm and this emotion is just being stuck into the body, waiting for later processing. In environments where the care is not the greatest, they're not sensitive to the fact that you haven't been able to resolve these emotional upsets, and so it simply waits to be processed later. And so you can have collected a lifetime of sadness in an emotional somaticized center in the body. You may be aware of them in terms of a cramping or contractive energy in the body. Some people experience them as heat. And this is the third main conduit to relapse, because when they begin to release emotion, you have these intense experiences of emotion which don't seem to be connected to anything that's happening in the present moment. So you may find yourself overcome by sadness and not be able to explain why you should be feeling sad at this moment. You may find yourself overcome by a sense of anger and not understand why you would be angry in that moment, or that you would have that intense of a reaction to something. You can store any emotion, but most of the time it's these intense, afflictive emotions. I would say most people who have addiction have this sense of sadness about them. This, I like to call it the terrible sadness. And a lot of people build addictive strategies around insulating themselves from ever having to have this experience of terrible sadness. And if you can get to a place where you can just be with it without needing to get away from it, a lot of the addictive strategies that you've developed will just fall away on their own, because you don't need to protect yourself from this. But in a childhood experience in where you're not cherished and not delighted in, it's a terribly painful situation to be in, and constantly overwhelming. And so you have this my teacher calls it the pool of poison and pain, which is a kind of Zen poetry to describe it. Now, the Western psychological people call it somaticized emotion. What you will need to be able to do is to locate these emotional centers in the body, bring a meditation technique to them, and simply allow them to release now. So intense waves of sadness or fear or whatever it is that you have. If you don't do that, then what you notice is that something happens. Let's say something happens, you have a big anger pool, and something happens in the present moment that's a two or three of anger, but it's a similar anger to what's in the pool, and so the pool resonates like a bell. And then you have a four or five release of anger from the pool. So all of a sudden you're responding with a seven or eight level of intensity of anger to the conditions of the present moment. And people are saying things to you like, "You seem to be overreacting. Has that ever happened to you?" So when you begin to have good clarity about this, you see this is the present moment, this is the old stuff, and if you can keep them separate, the old stuff can release in the background and you can respond at a level that's appropriate with the experience of the present moment. Is that making sense? But because these somaticized pools can release for a long period of time, the tolerating of this intense afflictive emotion is, or the inability to tolerate this afflictive emotion is one of the things that leads to lapsing or relapse. Is that making sense?
Yeah.
If you don't have awareness of them, doesn't necessarily mean you don't have them, and you can then do that kind of exploration for them. The last of the four modules is called Difficult Interpersonal Relationships, and this is about how you operate in relationships with other people. We are herd animals, and we are not meant to live in isolation. I think I like to talk about this in terms of attachment theory. But what I think is true is that most people who have addiction made a decision somewhere along the line that other people are so unreliable that I don't want to have to count on them. In particular, I don't want to have to count them to help me regulate my emotions. So I'm going to develop a way of being in the world that does not require me to rely on other people. If you don't use other people as a means of emotionally regulating yourself, then how are you going to do it? And most of us have begun to use substances and process addictions as a way of emotionally regulating ourselves that doesn't require us to count on anyone else.
So that is a substitute?
Yeah, it's a substitute for intimate personal relationships. So you have to change your mind about that. I would agree with you that your assessment of your caregivers was that they were not reliable and that you couldn't count on them. That makes total sense to me. But it is not true now. You don't have to depend on them to take care of you. You can find reliable people who will show up for you and take care of you, who will cherish you. You just have to look for them and put the time and energy into the relationships. One of the things about people who have secure relationships is they put a ton of resources into the relationships because they see the value of it. A lot of us who have addiction issues don't see the value of maintaining dependable relationships. So we don't put near enough energy into having them. And so this is something you have to change your mind about. It's totally worth changing your mind about, but it is also frightening to do it because of the consequences of what happened to you. People who grow up in secure households don't tend to have addiction-related issues. Does that surprise you? Maybe, maybe not. The most common a person who has addiction-related issues has had some trauma in childhood. That's a very common component. So that's also something to look at. It may not be obvious. In attachment theory, we're talking about the conditions that children, that we all as children face in our different homes, and the outcomes of that kind of treatment in terms of how we view ourselves and how we view the world. So people who were taken care of well enough as children tend to grow into a secure attachment, which they think of themselves as somebody who's capable of getting their needs met, and they think of the world as filled with people who will be happy to meet their needs. Really, they do. How much of the time do you think you needed to be responded to in a way that met your needs in order for you to develop that mind state? Turns out that it's 30% of the time. It's a low bar. When you got 30% on a test, 30% correct on a test, what was the grade they gave you? I point this out to you because I want you to know that your care was less good than that in order for you to develop addiction. So this is meant to take the blame out of you, that somehow you caused this or somehow this was a failing. This is actually an ordinary outcome for the experiences that you actually had, right? People who grow up into being dismissing, which is one of the attachment strategies, have the view of themselves as pretty awesome. I'm great. I'm fantastic. I do everything the best. Everything I have is the best. I'm an amazing human being. And I would reciprocate in relationship to you if you were actually up to meeting my needs. But since you're not, I'm just going to take from you whatever I want and not reciprocate in any way. Have you met people like that? That's called a dismissing attachment strategy. And their view is, I'm amazing, and let's face it, the problem is all of you, not me. Then that covers a deep, terrible sadness of having a childhood experience where none of their attachment requests were met, that they were constantly being rejected by their caregivers. Someone who grows up to be a preoccupied adult had a childhood where the care was inconsistent, that they never knew what to expect in response to their requests for care, and so they were constantly hypervigilant about doing things right and doing enough and being the person that their caregivers wanted so that they could get taken care of. And so they have the view of themselves as incapable of meeting their needs, but they have the view of everyone else as capable. And so really all they have to do is connect to somebody and get them to take care of them, and then they'll be able to make their way in the world. And then we hit the trauma line. This is, you know, abuse or some kind. And then we have fearful preoccupied and fearful avoidant in that. Fearful avoidant people see themselves as incapable of getting their needs met, but they see other people as being dangerous, that to express their needs to someone else or to ask somebody else to take care of them is actually exposing them to harm. So they tend to be very reluctant to do that. If we look at patterns of addiction, 30% of dismissing people tend to be addicted, and 70% of fearful avoidant people tend to be addicted. So that one of the things about paying attention to this is that we can begin to look at what our conditioning has done in terms of how we regard ourselves, and then also what our expectations are of other people. If your expectations are of other people that they're going to kill you, you're going to be very circumscribed in what you ask from them. If you think that you're justified in taking whatever you want from whoever you want to take it from, you're going to behave in a different way in the world. If you present it as dismissing to somebody who's secure, they won't be in relationship with you because they do mutual. When we look at really what a secure relationship with is, and I'll finish talking about this on that. Reliability is the ground level of secure relationships and mutuality. So mutuality means that I take care of you in a way that's meaningful to you, then you take care of me in a way that's meaningful to me. Have you ever been taken care of by somebody in a way that they liked, but really didn't have any relationship to what you liked? Doesn't feel that good. But I did this for you, I did that for you, I did this for you, I did that for you. I don't care about any of that. Why would you do that? If you knew me, you wouldn't do that. You know, those kinds of things. Oops, I've lost my thought. Oh, I know. So, reliability. One of the things about fearful avoidant people is they're not reliable. And so, I don't know if you've noticed that people, sometimes they reliably show up and sometimes they don't reliably show up. It's very hard to have a sense of safety in a relationship if you don't rely on the other person to show up for you. So the ground level, the base level of secure relationships is a felt sense of safety, that the other person is reliable and will take care of you in a way that's meaningful to you. You know that you're going to have to pay for that by taking care of them in a way that's meaningful to them, but the felt sense of safety comes from them reliably showing up and taking care of you in a good way. If that happens, then you attune to them. I'm attuned to you, can you tell? This attunement thing. Everyone else can tell. I'm attuned to you now. And now I'm attuned to you. When I place my attention on you and you on me, then we know that that's where our attention is, we're attuned. If you feel safe, you will allow yourself to attune to someone. And you'll reveal yourself authentically. You'll actually tell them who you really are. If you want somebody to take care of you in a way that actually has meaningfulness to you, you do eventually have to tell them who you are. But if you don't feel safe, you're not going to tell them, right? You're going to protect yourself. So that felt sense of safety that allows attunement and the revealing of yourself then allows the other person to take care of you in a good way, allows them to soothe you when you need to be soothing, allows for an empathetic exchange between people that's emotionally co-regulating, that's emotionally balancing. This opens up the possibility of exploration. You know, if you go out into the world and you really pursue things that have meaningfulness to you, you can get knocked sideways emotionally and not be able to right yourself. But if you can rush back to somebody who will attune to you, who will co-regulate you, then you can come back into balance easily. And that really supports your ability to explore what's meaningful. But if you have that with somebody that you know, and seeing them after 20 minutes or so, you're going to feel really in balance and well, you begin to delight in seeing them. And it's this felt sense of delight that is one of the hallmarks of a secure relationship. You see the person, and without them needing to do anything, you just light up with delight in seeing them. So some of us will know this experience from childhood and some of us won't. When you walked into the room, did your caregivers light up with delight or with something else? I can tell you, I grew up in a household where there was like no delight at all. I was not delightful to my mother at all. So I was kind of a burden. I think embarrassment is a better word. I would walk in and my mother would light up with embarrassment, which did not really work for me. So, do you know what I mean by that? Do you have relationships with people that when they see you, they just light up and they're delighted to have you, delighted to be in relationship with you? That's what you really want to find in that. And that opens this possibility for them being the great booster for you to explore. Is that making sense? Anyway, attachment is one of my great passions because I had a really crap childhood. I don't know, maybe you get a sense of that. I didn't function very well and I couldn't get anything to go right. And I did a lot of psychotherapy, a lot of meetings, a lot of different ways to try and figure it out. And then in a 10-minute radio broadcast about attachment, I heard the whole pattern of my life described as a fearful, avoidant person. And it opened up the possibility of knowing in a pointed way how to practice so that I could shift myself more into this secure way of being in the world. And then once you get to this place of being secure in the world and you've populated your life with people who are reliable and are delighted to take care of you, it is a whole different experience being on the planet than if you don't have that. And one of the things that's so characteristic about people who have addiction is that they're socially isolated. Social isolation is terribly painful. You get used to being in a constant level of pain, but don't underestimate how terribly painful it is to be socially isolated. And to be in intimate relationships with caring people eliminates that high level of pain. Remember when I said, this is the pain of using? And if you let your life get this painful, social isolation can make your life this painful, that this would look like a bargain for a little bit of relief from that. So really important to pay attention to that. So we have a choice to make. We could do a quick dyad, or we could do Q&A. What do you want? Q&A. Of course. Has anyone ever answered that question with a dyad? D-Y-A-D.
What is that?
We would sit facing each other and do a meditative exercise. Okay. Go ahead.
Just one announcement, and then we'll have a question. Thank you.
So, thank you. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Philip Murphy, and I'm a member of the Sangha here and a member of the board of directors. George is my teacher, and I'm grateful. I've been traveling with George for about a week and a half, and I'm grateful that he was able to be with us tonight. I hope you're enjoying his work. And a couple of quick things about George. He runs a 6-day-a-week morning meditation. It's a call-in. So if you go to metta-group.org, you can sign up for that. It's really valuable. And offers retreat, George mentions retreats and intensive classes. So as many of you know who are members of this community is entirely supported by the generosity of the Sangha. So George generously offers his time to be here. The staff presents and holds a container here. The volunteer leadership for the organization give their time and energy very generously. So we ask that if this program is meaningful to you, if you would consider making a financial contribution. This is how we make sure that we can continue to operate the center, and that these rich programs continue to be able to be offered. So thank you for your generosity.
There are baskets in the back.
Baskets in the back and at the front, back of the room and at the door on the way out. Thank you.
Can you talk a little bit more about how I was really intrigued by this idea of the storage of anger that we have and how it gets played out in this story, and we'll overreact in a particular situation on a 7 when it's really like a 4.
Right.
And I want to apply that to how we relate to other people, particularly in partnerships or romantic relationships and sobriety. Especially with people who did grow up with this like secure families where anger wasn't really present.
Right.
Anger was definitely present in my family of, you know, other alcoholics and codependents. And so I'm becoming more and more aware of like, oh, I'm angry, and I'm creating more and more of a story, and now I'm overreacting.
Right.
But I want to stop that. And of course, obviously, in the rooms, we learn about pausing, and we learn, you know, we learn all these kinds of toolboxes, you know. But I feel like there can be a deepening of the toolbox, perhaps. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about the moment you're having a conversation with someone, and the 7 comes out when you really should be at 0.
Right. So I would be watching for big angry self. If you know big angry self, it just sort of flashes and then you're a monster. Big angry self arises and passes. The longest it's really going to last is about 20 seconds, and then you start feeding it. So you just get used to recognizing, oh, it's big angry self, and just let it go before you take an action. There are 4 main kinds of emotion that you want to track. One is the present moment. It plays out on the surface, face, front of the throat, front of the torso, inside of the arms here and inside of the legs here. It's a vibratory energy. And it's constantly changing in response to the conditions of the present moment. The second one is self-generated emotion, and that's the emotion that's linked to thought. And that plays out in the same place, face, front of the throat, torso, arms. The reason that self-generation emotion is so effective in regulating the experience of the present moment is that it happens in the same spot, and it can completely displace awareness of the present moment. The third emotional experience is the somaticized emotional experience, and the fourth one is the empathetic experience of other people. So you want to be able to track the physical sensation of other people's emotion in your body so that you don't conflate it with your own, and that you don't and that they don't all combine into one massive emotional experience that then feels as if you need to change the conditions of the present moment at level 10. But actually, there's nothing about the present moment that you need to change. So it's part of it is sensory clarity, and then part of it is having some kind of alternative method of regulating. If you're expressing intense emotion, you're in a state of disequanimity, and so you need to bring online some kind of emotional regulation strategy that will help you hold the intensity of the emotion so that you're free to take a skillful action. But if you're responding in outbursts of anger, it's big angry self. That's what I like to call it. Do you know the Rumi poem, The Guest House?
Mm-hmm.
So do you use the Rumi method? Oh, big angry self, go sit in the corner, you know? But big angry self comes and goes. If you then let self-generated emotion fuel big angry self, it can go on. And then you have some people have big sad self, some people have big fearful self, you know. Watch that sense of they're doing something to me and I need to defend my experience of self. You don't need to defend an experience of self. Another way to look at it would be, this is what's happening, this is what you've done to me. That's making everything solid. We don't really experience what happens. We only experience what it means to us. And it means to us based on our conditioning. So that means that everybody else, because their conditioning is different, is experiencing the same thing differently than we are. So you can switch from, this is what's happening, I know that because I'm sensing it, and you did this to me because I'm sensing it, to, this is what I think is going on, what do you think is going on? So that you can really get into a dialogue about what your experience is. And if you can be authentic in that expression, it's really the most intimate, you know, this, if you can describe your experience of the present moment authentically to another human being, it's really the most authentic, because in the description that you give, it reveals your conditioning, the way that you experience the world. And if you allow them to respond in the way that they experience the world, then you have this real intimate exchange. If you insist that they adopt your point of view, you don't. They'll shut down. That's making sense.
Talk a little bit about, you mentioned other people's emotion and one's own emotion merging. Can you describe that a little bit and how to maybe prevent that from happening?
Sure. Have you heard the term empath? It's a popular term. So what really an empath's experience is that they lose track of their own emotional experience, and the empathetic experience of other people becomes the dominant emotional experience. So you want to have a clear understanding of what your feeling state is, and a distinct experience of what the other person's feeling state is. Empathy happens on three levels. The first is you have a visceral response to the witnessing of somebody else in physical pain. It's a kind of whinginess. The second is where you can look at them, read their facial expression and body language, then know what they must, how that is an indication of what they must be feeling internally. And the third is what we call a compassionate empathy, where you actually have physical sensations that map onto what your experience of their internal experience is. Is that making sense? Some people's conditioning will be that they don't really have any emotional sensations in the body. And so then you need to begin to learn what those emotional sensations are and what they feel like. Some people get totally caught up in, this would be a preoccupied person, gets totally caught up in the feeling experience of someone else and lose awareness of their own. But this is a matter just of sensory clarity and working with it. This is my emotion. This is my self-generated emotion. This is my pool, my somaticized emotion. And this is the empathetic experience. You want to have good clarity with all four. Is that making sense?
Sort of.
So we just need the experience part.
So how do you separate?
Well, you can track self-generated emotion by listening to the thought and then checking in the body what emotional experience is tied to the thought process. In the present moment, you can be just aware of the conditions of the present moment and your response to that. The somaticized stuff, you begin to track in the body where the intense contractive energy is and then follow that. And then with the emotional experience, you compare the second level of empathy, where you're reading the facial expressions and body language and then seeing if you can track internally an emotional experience based on that.
Can you talk a little bit about co-regulation and the different levels of engagement, the ABCD that you talk about? I think for me that's been really helpful, having different types of relationships to support me, and being aware of that and cultivating at different levels of intimacy and supporting my recovery.
So what Philip is referring to is a French neuroscientist named Robin Dunbar, and he came up with Dunbar numbers. Do you know them? There was an interesting piece in the New Yorker about it a couple of years ago. He wanted to know whether or not there was a capacity for the human mind to store faces and what that number was, and whether that number corresponded to the way that we structure organizations in society. And so what he determined was that active memory for human faces is around 150, so that you can remember about 150 faces in active memory. Have you ever had the experience of somebody walking up to you and recognizing you and then you not recognizing them, and then a couple of minutes later you recognize them? So you can have many more faces in long-term memory, but the buffer for automatic recognition is around 150, and if you meet somebody who isn't in the 150, you can bring them out of long-term memory, but you displace somebody in short-term memory. Then he wanted to know whether that corresponded to structures in society. He found it everywhere, in the military and corporations, everywhere, a number of 150. He even found that police departments use it as a multiple to calculate how many police they need. In groups smaller than 150, they tend to be self-policing because you can recognize everybody and know who's creating an offense. And as soon as you get beyond 150, you can't recognize everyone. And so artificial policing needs to happen. Then he decided to find out whether there was a certain number of people that you needed to know in order to be happy. And he tracked it and discovered that actually the number was pretty low. There's a division between people that you tell everything to and people that you tell some things to. So if I were to ask you, are there people that you tell everything to? So, and what I mean by that is, are there people that you're willing to tell them your authentic experience of the present moment without filtering it or spinning it or adjusting it so that they won't leave you? So he discovered that people tend to have A, B, C, and D relationships, and that A relationships are somebody that you take care of on a daily or every other day basis. This is the happiest people. And how many of those do you think you can have? Turns out that by a huge margin, one was the number. So one A relationship. And kids don't count because they're not supposed to be taking care of you. You're supposed to be taking care of them, right? And then B relationships are people that you actually see and that you take care of on a weekly or every other week basis, that you tell everything to. How many of those do you think you could have? There was a bell curve spread on that. How many of those do you have? Okay. So 2 to 5 was the range for that almost everybody fell into. But, you know, that would mean you were out 5 times a week sitting in with your friend and having lunch or dinner with them, right? That you're actively engaged in taking care of them. So I typically, my number is 4. I like to have 4 of those. So, and then below the line, see people that you see ordinarily in the way that you move around the world, say monthly or with a minimum of quarterly. How many of those do you have? You don't tell them everything, but you enjoy them and you like to keep up with them. So that was 30 to 40 was the number. And then D are people that you see at least once a year. And that is the remaining number of people. So when you come in, and addiction is one of your issues, social isolation is also typically one of your issues. And then how do you if you grew up in my family, there was no instruction at all of how to socially organize one's life. So this, I think, is a useful map for that. Now, if you want to have an A relationship, there's no need to have an A relationship, but most people like to have sex as a component of their A relationship because it's so energy intensive, but it's not necessary. And then your B's. If you have that, according to the Dunbar research, the happiest people, and this is people by far, a big gulf between levels of happiness, 60% of your energy goes into your A and B relationships, and 40% of your energy goes into your C and D relationships. So four or five relationships takes 60% of your time, energy, and resources to maintain. So to give you an idea of how intensive secure relationships are, I know that we think we put a lot of energy into relationships, but we also may feel we're not getting that much back. Mm-hmm. And that's because the relationships aren't in that category. And then 40% in the C's and D's. This was, however, not the most common distribution of energy. In Western culture, most people have an A, no B's, mm-hmm. and all the rest C's and D's, mm-hmm. and they put 40% of their relationship energy into the A, and 60% into the C's and D's. But the problem with having an A and no B's is what do you do for emotional regulation when your A is pissed at you? You're kind of out of luck, right? You just beg, kowtow, anything to get emotional regulation, right? So if you have B's, you can get emotional regulation, and it actually takes a lot of the pressure off the A relationship, so the A relationships can be more dynamic and free. We are out of time, so thank you.
I was just going to say that. Can we offer you the possibility of coming back and doing a day long?
I'd love to.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.